Govinda Dasi raised her hand. You said that after leaving this body, a person in Krishna consciousness goes to a higher planet. Prabhupada, no. If you make perfection of Krishna consciousness, then after leaving this body, you go directly to Krishna. But if you are not perfect, if you have simply executed a certain percentage only, then you'll get the chance of another human body. But one who has understood what is Krishna, how Krishna takes his birth, how Krishna acts, he doesn't get any more material birth. Then, where does he go? Jaktva deham punar janma naiti mam eti. He comes to me. That means in the supreme abode of Krishna. Therefore, we should be very serious. Why should we wait for another birth? Either in very pious family or rich family or in other planet. This human body can give you the highest perfection, but we have to be very serious and try for that perfection. But we are not serious. We are not very serious. Actually, human civilization means that people should be very serious to have perfection of this human body. That is the perfect human civilization. That is missing at the present moment. In other words, people are coming to the material world because they have material desire. It means desire other than Krishna, right? Other for other things. So this is best, in one sense, taken care of by, in all the different species of life, all the animals and birds and beasts and all this. Because there, then, it's just simply materially motivated, right? They're eating, sleeping, mating, defending. Is all just materially motivated, and they can do it fully. There's no problem, right? You know, the dog can chase the cat up the tree, and there's no reaction. It's not bad. You know, they can do whatever it is natural for them and be completely absorbed in it and get the full experience. But the human civilization is not meant for this. Human civilization is meant for going back to Godhead, right? That's its purpose. But a living entity means senses. So then these senses are engaged with the sense objects. But the purpose is still to connect it to the Supreme Lord, right? And this connection is not just some dry, speculative concept that spiritual just means nothingness or, you know, there's no interaction, nothing going on. That's not important. What's important is that it's relationship with the Supreme Lord, relationship with the devotees. So the spiritual life looks basically the same as what we would call life in the material world. But there it's all in connection with Krishna. Everything's connected to Krishna, right? And it's working in its, you know, most nice, natural, refined form. Well, here people, you know, create all kinds of different variety because there's, in human form, they're still trying to taste the animal sense gratification. Right, so they try in different ways to taste this, but it doesn't work so good as a human being. But in the animal life, it works very well. Does this make sense? Right. So the human civilization is meant, therefore, to understand God consciousness and to engage in God consciousness. And if we don't engage in that way, we get distracted by other things. We'll suffer. We'll suffer. Others will suffer. Everything will go funny. Yes? No. That wasn't a question. That was scratching. Does this make sense? In other words, what is disturbing in our life is what is mundane. Right? And what's not disturbing, that's Krishna consciousness. Right? Yes?
This point is very easily understood by devotees. Mm-hmm. But for those who are not devotees, to explain this point to them is very difficult, because as soon as we bring out the point of surrendering into Krishna, then they say that, oh, it's just your faith. I don't have faith in Krishna, and I don't have any.
No, but then, therefore you go back behind. What's the common point? You understand? Means we're saying surrender to Krishna, and they say, well, I don't have faith in Krishna. That's what you do. I do something else. But that's not the point that we're talking about. We're talking about surrender. And we're talking about ultimate surrender. So if they don't catch that, then you go into the point is everybody has to surrender to something. Right? I mean, it's just surrender to say, no, but I'm the modern person. I'm this, that. Yeah, but you have to surrender to your 9-to-5 job. You have to be a professional. If you're not a professional, you don't make it. You're not anything. You don't have a fancy apartment, fancy car, you know, fancy phone, fancy this, fancy that, you know, talk fancy, then, you know, you're useless. So you have to surrender to that. You have to serve that. You have to, in everything you're doing, always be conscious of, you know, that social position, or your modern position. And you have to, in every, you know, everything that you do, you know, you have to incorporate that way of thinking and endeavor into your life. So, you know, that's not a, you know, so we're talking about that surrender. Everyone's got to surrender. Even if you say, oh, I don't care about all this, I'll just go to the forest and do whatever I like. Still, you know, when you're hungry, you have to eat. You don't define hunger. You don't define that your stomach's going to growl. That's just, it's already there. It exists. You have to surrender to it and deal with it. Right? And you say, well, I won't even eat. I won't do anything. Then, you know, you have to surrender to dying. Because it's just the way it's going to go. Does this make sense? Right. So surrender is the main point. It's what you want to surrender to. That's your choice. It's not a matter of not surrendering. It's a matter of what you surrender to. Because whatever you surrender to, that's what you have to absorb yourself in. That's what you have to. That's what you have to be endeavoring for. That's what you have to identify with. So now it's just a matter of, well, who defines that? So, therefore, you can say, well, man defines it, okay, and then a particular group of men, okay, but it's not so universal. So you're saying modern, but it's only a particular group of people. Because, I mean, there's Aborigines in, you know, Papua New Guinea, who, they are also in the modern age, and they're doing what they want to do, because modern means you do what you like to do, isn't it? You know, like that. So they're doing what they like to do, you know. You know, a festival, they take some red clay and, you know, paint themselves up like that and get out the bows and arrows and go out and, you know, shoot something and have a party, you know. So, you know, it's like, you know, they're doing what they like to do. So it's just, so this modern concept means just some people are doing it. You try to expand it. Why? Because then economically it runs on, you know, I mean, everybody has to be into it. Then economically it works. Otherwise it doesn't work. So that surrender, yeah, so then, but all that's still going to be based on God's laws. God's made the concept of social status, economics, family structure, you know, like that. What you can do with what sense, you know, with your eyes you can see, you know, you can't taste. Or. So all this has been there, that laws of God is there. So becoming in line with God's laws. Then that's the point. So now it's a matter of you want to make up your own thing, which isn't actually very universal and doesn't match with everything. Or you can follow the already inherent laws that are there that God's created. You know, if they're not, you know, into that, there's just a higher power. There's laws. And so if you want to be happy, you have to fit in. So fitting in then means you'll do all that. Does that make sense? So in any case, you have to surrender. It's just a matter of what. So you want all this status and this and that, but as you get older, how do you maintain that all? You know? But so you want to have your relationship with your, you know, whatever few relations you have and that particular amount of dead matter that you consider important, you know, your car, your house or something. But you're going to die and go away, and it's going to fall apart and go away. So all that endeavor is put into something so temporary. What we're saying is that the same endeavor can be put in, but connect yourself with the Supreme, because that's eternal. Right? Then you get eternal benefit and then a temporary benefit. You know, if somebody says, yes, okay, I have a lakh of rupees, and so I'll invest it here, and I'm going to get back, you know, how you say, a lakh, you know, 100 rupees profit. And then after, you know, 50 years, then all that money will be gone. There'll be nothing left. No lakh, no 100 rupees. right? And so we're saying is you invest it and then it's eternally there. You know what I'm saying? So it's just a matter of science. It's you want to do that and that, because we can explain it all. It's all temporary. It's obvious. Everybody knows that. So I'm saying, the point is faith you're going to have. It's just what you put your faith in. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So in other words, when someone says something that there's a detail that may be a fight, you go back, what's behind it? What's the principle that they're working on? Because much of the time, they don't know it. That's why they're arguing. They weren't arguing. They would be discussing surrender and faith. But they're saying, well, I don't have faith. But they do have faith. They have faith. I go and I buy my air ticket. If I go to the airport, I can catch a plane. If I go to the bus station, you can't catch the plane. You know, you go there, and then that airline has issued it, then that you actually can go there, and they'll give you, you know, a ride in their airplane. That actually, there is an airplane, right? So you have faith, and you have faith that when you get on, and they say they're going to Bombay, when you get off the plane, you'll be in Bombay. You know, would people have faith in the airline if every time they went and got on, they get on the plane for Bombay, and then they end up in Madras, and then, you know, Madras said, this is crazy, I want to go to Bombay. Oh, then get on this plane, and then they end up in Lucknow. And then, you know, it's just keep, you know, they never end up to Bombay, you know. Or they get close, they, you know, like that, you know, they get to that, what's that? Huh? Pune, and then he says, yeah, why don't you catch a bus, you know, it's like that. Then the bus will take you to some other village, and then finally it's just easier to walk, right? And then everybody tells, you know, you say, oh, I'm looking for this address. Where is it? No, that way. You know, you walk a little while. Now you ask the next guy, and they go, oh, where's this? Oh, there. No, that way. You know, and then you walk a little more. And then the third guy, you ask, oh, where's this address? Oh, that way. You know? So it's like, I mean, every time I ask for directions, I've always had that happen. A whole bunch of people say this way, and then one person, no, it's all that way, you know? So either none of them know, or somebody's right and the others don't know what they're talking about. Okay, you understand? So human civilization's meant for God consciousness. That's what it's for. Right? So you can get, you know, a nice birth here and there, but better is to go back to Godhead or be born in the family of devotees. Because then you're already in contact with God consciousness, like that. One doesn't want to utilize that, you know, that's one's choice, but this is actually the purpose. Yes, what do you think? Yeah? No? Okay. Srila Prabhupada sat in silence for several minutes, not moving. No one in the audience made a sound. Finally, he reached over for his kartals and began loudly ringing them together and singing Govinda Jaya Jaya Gopala Jaya Jaya. And the devotees joined him. Govinda Jaya Jaya Gopala Jaya Jaya Radha Ramana Hari Govinda Jaya Jaya. It was Prabhupada's desire to see his disciples raise their Krishna consciousness to 100% in their present lifetime. They could do it too, because the chanting was absolutely potent. If there was something they didn't understand, he would explain it. Govinda Dasi hadn't understood. She had thought that a devotee was meant to go to a higher planet, but now she understood. And he had told them to become more serious. He knew they sometimes went to the donut shop and even smoked cigarettes after kirtans, and he tolerated it. But he let them know that he really wanted them to be completely serious. Unless they were completely serious, they might have to go to a higher planet within the material universe. And what good was that? To raise to a human birth took many lifetimes. Human life was meant for perfection, so they should be serious. But he had said, we are not serious. After the kirtan, Srila Prabhupada left the storefront and returned to his apartment. Hayagriva, turning to Haridas, asked why no one had thrown the crazy boy out. In New York, Hayagriva said, Brahmananda would have removed him at the first outburst. Because Brahmananda was big, you know. So. You have to be careful with the hippies here, Hari Das explained. Tactful is the word. In this neighborhood, if someone walks around high on LSD, people automatically assume that he is due all the respects of God and should be tolerated. They come in and jump up and down and scream, but we can't lay a hand on them because they are LSD saints. If we had touched that boy this morning, the whole neighborhood would be down on us. The diggers next door are pretty noisy, but they unplug their jukebox during lectures. And they've been very friendly, giving us clothing and helping us decorate the temple. Sometimes the Hell's Angels go over there and raise a lot of noise. And sometimes they even come in here. If they do, best to humor them. They are always trouble. Right, so here's this is the West Coast dynamic. Right, you know, East Coast is like, you know, hey, that's nonsense, you know. But the West Coast is, no, everything's, you know, try to. And you see they reciprocate. You know, devotees are careful, then the store next door in the Hell's Angels, I don't know if it'll come up in here, but it comes up at one point that actually the, No, it doesn't come up. Just that the Hell's Angels were there and they were making a lot of noise or something. Then the devotees actually went over and talked to them, the boss, because I think that's kind of where it started and all that. And somehow or another in the discussion, then the Hell's Angels understood what the devotees were doing and this and that. And so they kind of took it on as their official policy to protect the devotees. Like that. So they would take care. And then this relationship was there that when Mukunda and others, when they went to England, and that, then I'm not sure what they were doing. Yeah, they were there, they're trying to start a temple. And then they got a call, you know, to come pick one of the devotees was coming to pick him up at the airport, and also along with him were all these Hell's Angels from San Francisco, because they had come from San Francisco, and they had come, they brought their motorcycles and everything and all that. So they picked him up, and then they stayed with them wherever they were staying for some days. You know, the Hell's Angels with them taking prasad and this and that, and then they mentioned about they had some connection with the Beatles and all that, and they were going to go visit them, and if they wanted to come along or something. So they went there, and there was a whole crowd of people, and everybody was sitting there. And then George Harrison, all the Beatles came out after a meeting, just walked out, didn't even look at the people there, and then George Harrison came out and noticed, I think, Shamasundar sitting over in the corner. Walked up to him and says, you know, where have you guys been? So then after that, then they got, you know, that connection, and then they ended up living at John Lennon's house. He had just bought a new house and all that. So the devotees, big house, grounds, and they had so many cottages for the different servants, and, you know, the servants, the driver, the gardener, the guy who takes care of the horses, all this kind of stuff. So the devotees were living there, and they were helping refurbish the house. It was an old, run-down house. So like this, so these connections. This is the point. If you're careful and all that and have these relationships, then all this nice, all these things happen. You know. That very morning, some Hell's Angels started a fight in the digger's store. The devotees could hear thuds and screams through the walls as a big black beat up three Hell's Angels. Okay, normally it goes the other way around. The brawl ended only after a police car and an ambulance arrived. Afterwards, about a dozen people drifted into the temple, talking about the brawl. Harsharani put out extra plates for the guests. These guys just come from a big riot. They just kind of wander in. Okay, yeah, more people. One day in March, 18-year-old Wayne Gunderson was walking down the street when a piece of paper blowing along the sidewalk caught on his foot. He tried to kick it off without breaking his stride, but it hung on. Then he stopped and tried to kick it off. He couldn't. He reached down and picked it off and found it was a flyer, "Stay High Forever," advertising lectures by Swami Bhaktivedanta at 518 Frederick Street. This is Krishna, right? Flyer going down, it sticks on your leg and you can't get rid of it. Like so many others, Wayne, a mild-mannered young man who worked for the post office, had come to Haight-Ashbury to take part in the revolution. He attended rock concerts and be-ins, browsing through the books and posters in the psychedelic shops, shared an apartment with his girlfriend and another couple, and took drugs. But he was quiet, polite, and solitary. He didn't dress like a hippie, but he wore clean, conservative, casual clothes and a whimsical, odd-looking sports cap. The flyer about the Swami seemed a timely coincidence, because Wayne had been planning to go to India to find a guru. He decided to go to see Swami Bhaktivedanta on Frederick Street. Wayne was surprised to find only a storefront. He was startled by the picture of the Swami in the window. No smiling bearded yogi, but a shaven-headed Swami with a stern look. Right, because that was the standard thing of the 60s, you know, the Indian Swamis with the long beard and the long hair and the robes, and they're always smiling, giving blessings, and always very nice, and everything goes, no, it's okay, you know, because everything's just supposed to be bliss and all this. So he's a bit surprised. Here's this guy with a shaved head, you know, no long hair, and then, he's looking very sober. Wayne went in. It was a typical Haight-Ashbury scene, with hippies sitting around. But there were also a few people with big red beads strung like garlands around their necks. And up front, he saw the Swami. Wayne was impressed as Prabhupada began chanting Hare Krishna, and he found the lecture firm and authoritative. The Swami stressed, "We are not these bodies." And when he spoke of Krishna, he described Krishna so personally that it was like being introduced to Krishna. After a few meetings, Wayne got up the nerve to ask a question. Can one practice Hatha Yoga at the same time as Krishna consciousness? Oh, why do you want to spend so much time with that body? Prabhupada replied. And Wayne felt Prabhupada's eyes look deep within him. You are not that body. He said it so strongly that Wayne, who was easily hurt, felt like shrinking into the floor. This body is not as important as the soul, Prabhupada explained. So we shouldn't spend so much time with the body, exaggerating its needs. Then he smiled at Wayne. Besides, all yogas culminate in Krishna consciousness. And Wayne felt that smile lift him completely out of his diminished and crushed condition. Right, so that's the thing, one is sensitive so that one can see whatever one's doing, what response is happening, immediately then one's adjusting. Right, so Prabhupada's given that stern so he understands the point, but at the same time, it's because he reacted, he's very shy, so then he became, you know, very unsure, so then Prabhupada smiled, and then that brought him back. Yes? No? What do you think? Up late last night? Yes? Why, what's special about last night to be late, up late? You just said yes. What if I said, but that's not actually what I said. I said we need a volunteer to clean all the toilets with a toothbrush, and would you be interested? That's actually what we said. Wasn't it going? Yeah. Anyone else heard that?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, see, they all heard that. You think they're all absolutely out of your minds, but maybe it's because you were half asleep, you weren't paying attention, so you didn't notice all the, what I was saying. You probably thought I was talking about, we have a whole bunch of Mahaprasad and would you be interested or something. That's why he said yes. He said, you know, you didn't catch it. It wasn't yes, it was yes. like that. It was that. It says, so you want to clean the toilets? And they said, yes. Yeah, that's what they wanted. Yeah. So. You don't want to clean toilets like that. You absolutely refuse to clean toilets.
I'm in pumps this week.
You're in pumps this week. You wear pumps. Yeah, that's the whole point, is the figure in there. Adi's getting worried now. You can see this look in his eye of slight fright. I would not recommend wearing them when you're cleaning the bathrooms, though. You know, you might make a difficult trip over, you know, because you want to be able to lean back so when you're cleaning, you don't fall forward. But the highness of the heels, you might fall in. So I would avoid the pumps this week. You know.
I was totally into wearing them, but now...
Okay, yeah, that's good. See, the Vedic form is the front should also be high. Then it works like that. Yes?
He's not going to be in the pumps, then he's
going to
be in the toilets.
Yes, of course. That's what I'm saying. You should avoid the pumps this week and just stick to the toilets.
If he wears pumps, then no need to go back and forth for water.
That's also there. Take your own water with you. If you're wearing the pump, you have the pumps and go with you and get all the water you want.
She's talking about originated from Russia. I've concluded this.
He's originated from Russia. How have you come to this conclusion?
There's a story where a Russian person went to France and saw taps.
Uh-huh.
He was very amazed that you just turned them out of water. So they went into a house, they raided the whole house, took all the taps, went back to Russia, stuck them in the wall, and turned them into the water was coming out. So Chaitanya seems to be under that same sort of illusion.
But you're leaving out one part, important part of the discussion. There, you're inferring that they took the tap and then tried to use it. But he's referring to someone actually wearing them. you understand? I mean, the one is crazy, right? They take the tap and try to put it in like that. But then to wear the tap, isn't that a little bit more wild? I mean, it might be cool, you know, sticking off the top. What would you do with the shower head, though? Well, actually, you could, I guess, mount it on the back. You just have to watch out when you bend over, you know, like that. You don't hit somebody. But in the bathroom might be also a problem, because if you try to bend over, you hit the back wall, and then you won't be able to clean properly, you know. So just keep all this in mind, okay? Very good. Thank you. Yeah? If you need any inspiration for how to wear them, then he's got some ideas. But he could have used the shower thing yesterday. He's going over the bridge yesterday. Somebody fell off the bridge. Right? You know, like that. So. Oh, no, you're from Dubai. Okay. I was going to say, the last guy that did that was from Iceland. So that's, I guess that's it. Now that would that be a contradiction? Now one guy's coming from where it's ice, and the other guy's coming for it's sand. You know, it's so hot there is no ice, and the other place is so cold there is no sand. So, what's the connection, you guys? I'm not sure. Don't know. Hmm? You don't think there's a connection, but you both fell off the bridge. There is some connection. Okay. Several weeks later, Wayne asked about initiation. When the devotee, like that, you know, it's like, been around a long time, it's been a few weeks now, you know, so what about initiation? When the devotees told him he should go up and see the Swami, Wayne went home and rehearsed his lines first, anticipating what Prabhupada would say. Wayne prepared his own responses and contrived the whole conversation. Then nervously, he approached Prabhupada's door. But before he could even knock, the door opened, and there was Prabhupada looking at him, right? So he's got this whole thing, knock, and then Prabhupada will come, and then he'll say his thing. So before he goes to knock, the door opens, and Prabhupada's there, right there. Now his whole speech is gone, right? And there was Prabhupada looking at him, not sternly, as in his picture, but kindly, as if expecting him. Yes, Prabhupada said, come in. The incident completely shattered Wayne's planned approach. He concluded that Swamiji could read minds. So, trying to clear his mind of bad thoughts, he entered Prabhupada's apartment. There was one, I forget where it was. I don't know if it was Los Angeles or something, that Prabhupada had his quarters in his room, and there was a guard outside the room. The devotee was there guarding. And, you know, you could hear things happen, but then there was nothing happening for a while. There's no sound, so the devotee was just wondering what's going on. So then he went up to the door, and he had, at least the old doors, they had these keyholes. You could see right through. So he goes up to look in the keyhole. When he looks in the keyhole, Prabhupada's eye is on the other side of the door. Prabhupada would do that sometimes. What's going on? Yes. Prabhupada sat in his rocking chair, and Wayne, who usually sat on the floor, sat in the only other chair in the room. Wayne immediately felt uncomfortable, as he realized it would be more proper to sit at Prabhupada's feet. But feeling too weak-hearted to alter the situation, he kept his seat, nervously fingering his sports cap. Swamiji, he began, I would like to be your disciple. Prabhupada immediately agreed. He asked whether Wayne could follow the four principles, and Wayne, although not even sure what the four principles were, said he could. Prabhupada then asked him what principle was the most difficult for him to follow. Well, he said, I have difficulty with meat eating. A lie, he was a vegetarian. But he was too shy to say this real problem was uncontrolled sexual desire. Prabhupada laughed. Oh, that's no problem. We will give you prasadam. You can be initiated next week. Wayne then asked if he would be able to go to India. He felt the Swami would be pleased to hear that this new follower wanted to go to his country, but Prabhupada seemed displeased. India? Why India? Wayne thought, the real reason he had wanted to go to India was to find a guru. Well, he said, to learn Sanskrit. I will teach you Sanskrit, Prabhupada replied. So there was no need to go to India. And he would be initiated by a genuine guru next week, right here in San Francisco. Some devotees helped Wayne prepare for his initiation ceremony. Hayagriva lent Wayne his dhoti, a piece of yellow cloth much too large for Wayne. Devotees set up a sacrificial arena in the storefront, a bed of earth, firewood, colored dyes, flowers. During the ceremony, Wayne was nervous. When Prabhupada chanted the mantras, Wayne couldn't hear them exactly, so he just mimicked as best he could. And when Prabhupada began the fire sacrifice, Wayne felt a little frightened because the initiation seemed such a serious commitment. He watched Prabhupada gravely building the fire and saying the mantras. When Prabhupada initiated Wayne with his new name, When Prabhupada initiated Wayne with his new name, Upendra, Wayne didn't hear it clearly and began to worry. Then the ceremony ended, and Prabhupada stood up and abruptly left the storefront. Upendra, you know, in later time became one of Prabhupada's main servants. He was with him probably one of the most of anybody. Upendra, someone reminded me that I should go upstairs and give Swamiji an offering. So I decided to give him a baby blanket and a beach towel. It wasn't that I lacked money, but these things had some sentimental value to me. So I wanted to give them to Swamiji. I went upstairs to his room, and he was sitting at the foot of his mattress. I came in and bowed down and presented him with the baby blanket and the beach towel. He held them up in his fingers and looked at them in each of his hands. He said, "These things are useless." And he tossed them down on the floor. I was hurt and I had nothing to say. I just sat there. After a while, I excused myself and went back to my apartment. The next day, I went to see Swamiji during his evening visiting time, and he had the beach towel and baby blanket out on the floor like rugs so that his guests who come to visit could have something to sit on. I felt satisfaction that he had found some use for my offerings. Right, because it was sentimental value to him, but it didn't mean it had any importance to Prabhupada. You know, it was something that he could use. You know, like that, because the gift should be something that's of benefit for the person you're giving. But this was, you know, he had some. So it's nice that the sentiment was there that something of value to him he wanted to give, like that. So that's the basic principle, but it should also be common. So, you know, that point is there is to break that just sentiment. But at the same time, it's because it was given, then Prabhupada was found some way to use them. You know? So they ended up on the floor as rugs for people to sit on. Because the beach towel is very, very big towel. They're monster towels. So, and, you know, it's big. You can, a few people can sit on it. Prabhupada said that Upendra was not living up to his vows, since he was still living with his girlfriend. Upendra felt guilty about breaking the principles forbidding illicit sex and intoxication, but he just couldn't follow them. He wanted to tell Swamiji, but couldn't bring himself to do it. Besides, he thought, even if he confessed, how could he stop? Upendra's girlfriend didn't like Krishna consciousness, didn't want to meet Swamiji, and didn't want to come to the temple. So Prabhupada decided that instead of marrying Upendra to her, he would save Upendra from her. Prabhupada decided to make Upendra a brahmachari. Although Prabhupada had about 25 San Francisco disciples, hardly any were brahmacharis. Practically the only solid one was Jayananda, who was a little older than the rest. Jayananda worked all day driving a cab, chanting Hare Krishna even while driving. And when he was off work, he would be at the temple, cooking or doing any service he could find or sitting with Prabhupada in his apartment with the other devotees. He was known for a serious japa, sitting cross-legged, eyes squeezed tightly shut. He would hold his strand of beads up in both hands and rock forward almost to the floor and back, chanting intensely, oblivious of the outside world. He was serious. And that was the only way one could remain a brahmachari. In New York, Prabhupada had about a dozen brahmacharis, but a more permissive attitude among his followers in San Francisco made brahmachari life more difficult. In the original Vedic society of ancient India, brahmachari life began at the age of 5. Parents would send their son to live with the guru at the gurukul, where the boy would receive basic training, spiritual instruction, and strict moral discipline under the guru. Even Lord Krishna, in his transcendental pastimes on earth, had attended a gurukul and very humbly served his spiritual master. The basic principle of brahmachari life was celibacy. By practicing celibacy, the brahmachari would develop great powers of memory and sensory control. And if such a trained brahmachari later decided to take a wife, his sex life would be regulated, not licentious. But although brahmachari life was necessary for a healthy society, Prabhupada seen within his own lifetime the rapid the rapid deterioration of brahmacharya to almost to non-existence. And in America, the situation was, of course, much worse. Srimad Bhagavatam tells of a young brahmana, Ajamil, who fell from spiritual life because he had seen a drunken man embracing a half-naked prostitute. In America, to see a half-naked prostitute in public was not uncommon. As soon as a brahmachari walked out on the street, he would confront so many allurements. But Prabhupada was convinced that brahmacharis could protect themselves, even in America, if they regularly chanted Hare Krishna and sincerely tried to follow the rules and regulations. Krishna would protect them. Prabhupada had decided to ask Upendra to come and live with him as his personal servant. Prabhupada's former servant, Ranchor, had recently left his position. Although supposedly a brahmachari, he had never been a serious brahmachari. He had even seduced one of the young women devotees in New York. Prabhupada had found out and had asked the girl why she had indulged in sex with Ranchor if she wasn't planning to marry him. Prabhupada's why had so disarmed the girl that she had been unable to answer. Prabhupada had admonished her, "You girls should not make yourselves so cheap," and had given Ranchor another chance. But Ranchor never became serious. After playing the drums during the big kirtan and at the Avalon Ballroom, Ranchor had become fascinated with the dance hall. He would sneak out from his service, lie to Prabhupada about his absence, and go looking for girls at the Avalon. One day he never returned. As one of the devotees reported to Prabhupada, he just disappeared into the strobe lights. Ranchor did come back once to ask Prabhupada for money so he could return to his home in New York. Upendra, despite his weakness, was spontaneously attracted to Prabhupada and liked to be with him whenever he could. Sometimes Upendra would go up to the apartment with one or two other devotees and just sit in front of Prabhupada as Prabhupada sat on the thin pillow behind his low desk. In other words, the point is the brahmacharis are practicing. They're trying their best to practice and everything. And the girls are also then very strict about all this, right? They're not making themselves available, not making themselves cheap, right? So that's the thing is cheap. So what it means something that's on the street and the price is low, right? It's easily available, right? Does that make sense? That's called cheap. Right, something expensive, it's not on the street. You have to go inside an establishment or something to see it. Right, it's carefully guarded. The price is very high. Right, but its value is much greater. Right, does that make sense? Something off the street isn't valued much. Something that's hard to get, something that's more rare, is more appreciated. Does that make sense? So remember the next time you're pushing little buttons that have letters on it and pushing send. Upendra Sometimes Upendra would go up to the apartment with one or two other devotees and just sit in front of Prabhupada as Prabhupada sat on the thin pillow behind his low desk. Sometimes Prabhupada would continue reading or writing, and Upendra would just sit and bask in his presence, simply watching him work. After 10 minutes or so, Prabhupada would look up and say, "All right, that is enough." Because they're just sitting there and Prabhupada, "Oh, this is ecstasy being here," and like this. And then after 10 minutes, "Okay, that's enough. You can go now." You've had your basking, you know. And the boys would bow and leave. Upendra would also go to see Prabhupada taking his lunch, and Prabhupada would take some rice and vegetable from his plate, put them on a chapati, and offer them to Upendra. Although the prasadam was similar to the prasadam the devotees ate downstairs, Upendra thought that it would taste it much better. One day when Upendra was alone with Prabhupada in his room, Prabhupada asked, "Are you living with a young girl and people who take intoxicants?" For the second time, Upendra was convinced that Swamiji could read his mind and knew his entire life. Yes, Upendra admitted, but I am not having, Prabhupada interrupted, that is not good. Swamiji, I am not having any sexual connections. Where there is a boy and where there is a girl, Prabhupada said, there is sex. You must come and live with me. Upendra was delighted. Yes, I'll come immediately. He took a few belongings from his apartment, left everything else with his girlfriend, and moved into the front room of Prabhupada's apartment. He was now Swamiji's personal servant. Prabhupada requested him to keep his job at the post office. Around midnight, as soon as Upendra got off work, he would have returned to the apartment. Prabhupada always left the door unlocked for him. Usually soon after Upendra locked the door, crawled into his sleeping bag, and fell asleep, he would be awakened by Prabhupada speaking into his dictating machine, composing teachings of Lord Chaitanya. Upendra would nod off again and sleep until 6. Upendra relished this close association with his spiritual master and became always cheerful. I just want to be Swamiji's dog, he would often tell the other devotees. One time Upendra was reading to himself from Bhagavatam. The whole subject matter is so presented through the lips of Srila Sukadeva Goswami that any sincere audience who will lend his ears submissively to this message of the transcendental world will at once relish the transcendental mellows distinguished from the perverted mellows of the material world. The ripened fruit is not dropped all of a sudden from the highest planet of Krishna Loka, but it has come down carefully, being handled by the chain of disciplic succession, without any change or disturbance, in the formation of the soft and ripened fruit. You don't have any questions? Prabhupada asked. Upendra looked up from the book. No, Swamiji, I accept everything you say. Prabhupada began rocking strongly in his rocking chair and smiled as Upendra kept reading. Then Prabhupada taught Upendra the proper way to hold a book while reading, with the palms of both hands up and off the lap. This advice gave Upendra greater enthusiasm to please his spiritual master by reading his books. And that's, you hold the book up like this. Okay, so end here. We'll continue on Thursday with more Upendra pastimes.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki,
Jai
Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki,
Jai
Nitai Gaura Premanandi.